Hello and welcome to this extra inning of The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan US Centre here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan US Centre's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. In March 2024, I spoke to Professor Elizabeth Sanders, Professor of Political Science at Columbia University. Professor Sanders' research and teaching interests focus on the domestic politics of international relations and US foreign policy, especially the role of leaders, the presidency, and the politics of using force. We spoke about a new book, The Insider's Game, How Elites Make War and Peace, and about the role of elites in U.S. foreign policymaking. Well, thank you so much for coming to speak to The Ballpark today. To start things out, could you say a few words about your current research focus and work? Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here in The Ballpark that's not in the United States. As an avid baseball fan, I found it quite nice that you named your U.S. podcast The Ballpark. My research has always been focused on domestic politics and foreign policy, and in particular, domestic politics of war and peace. So at the moment, my main project is not working on my second book anymore because it's finally done after many, many years. But I am quite focused on the upcoming U.S. elections, and I have some new research underway on the politics of global governance and the politics of domestic support for global governance, and a few other irons in the fire, but still always focused on the politics of war.
Fantastic. Thank you. So your new book is The Insider's Game, How Elites Make War and Peace. Could you talk through the main arguments and themes you set out in your book?
Sure. So this book arose from a puzzle that really struck me going all the way back to the 2008 primary season, when Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were locked in a very intense battle for the Democratic nomination. Seems like, and it was, a lifetime and many different iterations of U.S. politics ago. But it was quite formative for me just starting out as an assistant professor at George Washington University, where I then taught. And I would go to lunch with my colleagues who studied American politics, and they would talk a lot about the primary and the way people voted. And I began to feel like it didn't quite fit with the way international relations scholars were talking about voting. So they would talk about things like ballot order effects. So the alphabetically first candidate would get more votes. And so that had led to reforms of randomizing names and so forth. And then I would go back and read some of the literature in international security and the politics of war. And it would sort of imply that people were voting on the basis of presidents' records or Democratic leaders' records in war and peace. And that just did not seem to fit. So I began sort of a small project on that, and it quickly became clear that it had to be a book, that it had to delve into questions of democratic accountability and develop a new theory of elites and how elite politics is really different from mass politics. So in this book, I really try to make the point that it is part of democracy to treat elites as political actors, and it's not necessarily a perversion of democracy. It's part of democratic decision making, and that it is natural and normal for elites to be making decisions on behalf of voters, but that they don't always do so exactly the way the voters want, but that this is still democratic. And so the things that you see in elite politics are really different from what you see in mass politics. You see bargaining, you see careerism, you see horse trading, things that might seem a bit unseemly or icky in the context of national security. But this is part of how decisions get made. And so a theme of the book is that we have to confront this and understand it and confront it head on rather than sweeping it under the rug. And I'd say, you know, the way I sort of think about elites in foreign policy and war is, you know, you can't live with them and you can't live without them. So it's a book that tries to be clear-eyed about what elites can do and why expertise and competence is important, and also understand the biases and problems that arise from elite politics, and, you know, move beyond, oh, we must have only technocratic experts, or, oh, elites are all a cabal of warmongers. It's neither as good as all that nor as bad as all that.
Thank you. So your book, in its titles and its topics, centers around this idea of elites. Can you talk a bit about who these elites are for our listeners and what elite consensus is that you talk about in your book? And in what ways does an elite consensus diverge from what the voting population of citizens of a country think? And how does this result in decisions about war and peace?
Sure. So the definition of elites was a pretty vexing problem in this project for a while, because I would settle on something and people would say, well, so what about so-and-so, or what about so-and-so? And eventually I decided, you know, for any given decision about the use of military force, many different kinds of elites can have influence. But there are three groups that I think in any democratic country will always have influence in any decision about using military force. One is military leaders, and there's a pretty rich literature on civil military relations, as I'm sure many listeners are aware. Another, members of Congress, or more generally democratic legislators. And the third, which gets far less attention to this point, are advisors and bureaucratic officials that work directly in the executive branch. And so I talk about all three in the book, but those are the three that I focus on. And in particular, I give a lot of emphasis on advisors, because they are not elected, but they are nonetheless political actors. They have their own ambitions. They have their own views. They may be politically aligned with the president or not. So I think it's important to treat them as the political actors that they are. And so one of the themes of the book is that the alternative that I'm kind of trying to move the literature away from a little bit is this idea of direct voter accountability. So it's not that voters are ignorant or should be paying more attention. This is a natural way we all make sense of a really complicated world, right? You didn't have me on this podcast to talk about healthcare policy. If you had, I would have said, you're out of your mind. But what we all do is we specialize in certain things. And then on other things, we take cues from either trusted people we know or experts or the media. And this is how we all navigate the world. And so this is not meant to be an indictment of the voters or any sort of suggestion that elites are better, quote unquote. It's just kind of confronting the world as it is. And so the assumption of most of the literature, though, is that elites are representing the voters' preferences faithfully. They're what I call in the book the faithful intermediaries of the voters. And so maybe they get it right, maybe they get it wrong, but they always are trying to do exactly what the voters want, to the extent we can ever settle on understanding a single thing that the vote, like one single preference that voters have over war and peace. But that just, to me, is unrealistic, right? Elites aren't saints. They have their own ambitions. They want other things, perhaps. Maybe some of them don't care that much or don't focus that much on issues of national security, but they care passionately about something else. And so they know that they can make deals with people to get what they want in return for bargaining with people that care a lot about national security. They may have future career ambitions. They may have future political ambitions. They may have just very strong views on a particular country or region. And to sweep that under the rug, I think, is missing a huge amount of what drives decisions about war and peace. And so the elite consensus that I talk about in the book really derives from American political scientists' study of how voters take cues. They take shortcuts. And the simplest way to explain it, and here I'm drawing on the work of John Zoller and Adam Barinsky, who worked a lot on voting behavior and war. When elites are united or agree publicly, there's elite consensus, which also might mean just the absence of dissent, which is not quite the same thing. But when they present a for all intents and purposes, united front, the public will generally follow. When the elites are divided, then the public will generally support whichever side they agree with in terms of partisanship. So Democratic voters will follow what the Democratic Party is doing and Republican voters likewise with Republican leaders. But in that work, the elite consensus kind of drops from the sky. It's just given. And one way to understand that is to think of the voters as delegating to elites, you know, you figure out if this is a good idea or not. If there's consensus, you go off and fight the war. And if there's dissensus, call us, right? And we'll pay attention. And that's an exaggeration, but the voters are sort of using elites as a fire alarm. What I think is very interesting is how often what looks like consensus is actually the product of intense political bargaining. So consensus doesn't drop from the sky, and often it is a huge preoccupation of the president and his political team. So think of the Iraq War. The Bush administration had a relatively easy political path, but they went to some lengths and expended tremendous political capital and put tremendous pressure on members of Congress to vote for the authorization for the use of military force in 2002, right before the November 2002 midterm elections. And in the wake of 9/11, this really put pressure, especially on opposition Democrats in Congress, to support the war. And so that elite consensus, quote unquote, was really the product of a lot of political bargaining and pressure and politicking. And we could go into that in more detail, but I think it's just important not to treat elite consensus as if it's always a faithful representation of what elites believe is the right thing or the thing that the voters actually want.
Thank you. Could you talk a bit more about why elites have a disproportionate amount of influence on foreign policy and whether this is an apt thing or something that's potentially good or bad?
Well, I've thought a lot about whether foreign policy, like how different is foreign policy as an issue, right? And I got this question a lot, like why isn't this true of tax policy, or why isn't this true of other budgetary questions? And I think it is true of those things. I mean, we know that people care more about sort of pocketbook issues, and, you know, the UK is in a cost of living crisis, and that comes up a lot. But the way that these things are framed politically is also quite important. And the general idea that elite consensus about issues is a very important way that voters get information about complicated issues is, I think, relatively universal. So I don't know that foreign policy is that different. Where you do have differences, there's a huge information gap, obviously, and some of that is the result of the understandable need to keep secrets and national security needs and sources and methods and so forth, right? I mean, the government shouldn't be telling the public or even most members of Congress or, you know, backbenchers and so forth, everything all of the time. But I think it's not necessarily disproportionate, right? It's more at one end of a spectrum, but all of these issues to some extent are subject to this kind of shortcuts, right? We all use shortcuts in our daily lives, as I said before. I think it's also important to note that it's not as though it's just elites as a group and voters, you know, and everybody else. There is a tremendous amount of variation in how informed and how much power elites have. So one of the things I do in the book, I mean, this is a book not just about elites leading the mass opinion or shaping mass opinion. It's also about elites shaping elite opinion. So there are members of Congress who focus on healthcare and not on national security. And when there's a major episode or something that needs to be voted on, you would see this in the Cold War arms control context, for example. Should I vote for this arms control deal? Do I need to know all the details of nuclear policy to make an informed choice? Or should I just listen to Sam Nunn, who was the Democrats' sort of leading defense authority in those years? So many elites actually take shortcuts, and that's, again, quite natural. And that's why we should understand it as natural. So the president and his or her, hopefully someday her, inner circle has a lot of access to information, more access than members of Congress. Some members of Congress are read in earlier in these decisions than others. And as I know, one of your recent guests, Andy Rudilevich, has studied extensively, presidential power has increased dramatically in the foreign policy and national security arena, especially since September 11th, but really through the whole Cold War period. So the power of elites in foreign policy and national security is the product, you know, not just of the issue, but also these sort of broader trends. It's not just with respect to the voters. It's also the president versus other elites.
So what is the insider's game that your book is about?
The insider's game is, I think, a way of understanding elite decision making in a political context that doesn't completely ignore the voters. The voters are always there in the background. They do care about war and peace, but they don't necessarily have fully formed or strong opinions about anything in about particular crises or regions. The insider's game tries to understand who really has leverage and when and what types of bargains get struck. And so I try in the book to, you know, it's one thing to say elites are in charge and make these decisions and they bargain. But the question is, what does that actually add up to? Does it add up to more war than the voters would want, or less war, or different wars, or longer wars? And so this is where I start to get into the details of which party is in power and what are the incentives for different presidents of different parties. And so it always struck me, looking back over the history of American national security decisions, that you have two themes. One is that Democratic presidents have lived almost in constant fear of being called weak on national security, going back to Harry Truman. Even before Harry Truman, but in the modern era of power projection and military intervention since the end of the Second World War, this idea of Democrats as kind of wimpy doves has haunted Democratic presidents, even those with hawkish inclinations. And at the same time, Democrats have fought a lot of wars, long, bloody wars. And so these two things always, that struck me as a puzzle, right? They fight all these wars, and yet they have been just constantly looking over their shoulders, so to speak. And so as I sought to kind of think about this insider's game, I tried to think about, well, why is that? And I came up with a sort of relatively simple proposition, which is that dovish leaders who would really prefer not to use military force in most cases have a harder time being themselves than hawks do. So what do I mean by that? So dovish leaders who want to make a dovish choice to stay out of a conflict, to make peace, to accept a bargain, live in, as I said, in fear of being tarred as weak on national security, and they can't really be, they can't credibly say to the voters or other elites, this is the right decision for national security reasons, because the voters won't necessarily trust that they're doing it for national security reasons and not because they're just sticking to their dovish guns, right? So when they want to make that choice, they have to, if they want to be politically safe, it would be good for them to have the backing, say, of some hawks from outside their administration or inside their administration. But the politics of this are much, much tougher for doves than it is for hawks. And there are three reasons for that. One is selection. So there's a lot of selection pressure on dovish leaders to bring some hawks on the inside, right? There's a long tradition of Democratic presidents asking Republicans to serve as their secretaries of defense, for example, but it's never gone the other way. And I think that's quite interesting. And you have lots of other sort of positions where you would, Harry Truman actually brought John Foster Dulles into his administration as a special advisor, precisely because he wanted a Republican who would sort of bless his China policy at a time when it was under fire from McCarthyism and the Red Scare. So doves have a real pressing need sometimes to bring hawks on the inside. But of course, once they're on the inside, they have a front row seat for decision making, and they can both recommend hawkish policies or complain about the policy if it isn't sufficiently hawkish to their liking. which they often threaten to do. So that kind of, again, pulls policy more off the dove's preference and more towards the hawkish end. The second is what I call agenda costs. So it's not always the case, but it's typical that dovish leaders are more associated with the left or the center left, and they typically have other things they want to do. Barack Obama wanted to pass healthcare, not extend the war in Afghanistan. Lyndon Johnson famously, I mean, I don't even know if I can use Lyndon Johnson's words on this podcast because it's always, Lyndon Johnson's always too colorful to quote verbatim, but he said in far more colorful language, if I didn't fight in Vietnam, it would hit me with that and I would never be able to pass the Great Society legislation. So your listeners can Google the exact quote so that I don't have to say swear words on this podcast. But one could quibble over whether he was correct or not, but there's a lot of evidence that he believed that he had to neutralize Vietnam as an issue in order to get the Great Society passed. So these agenda costs or the political opportunity costs are higher for doves than they are for hawks, for whom national security is a much more central part of their political identity. And then the last is sort of the what I call the price of obtaining elite support for acting according to type. So let's imagine that a dovish president wants to make a dovish move, stay out of a conflict or make peace, et cetera. And they want to get a hawk to back them. The hawk really prefers to see the dovish president fight. The hawkish advisor or the hawkish member of Congress doesn't get a lot out of backing, say, a Democratic president making peace. So in order to obtain that sort of counter-type support, the Democratic president is going to have to pay a high price to get that hawk on board, right? To get the hawk to bless the peace. Whereas if the hawk wants to fight, which is kind of the hawks being themselves, Democratic elites often find it more expedient to just, even if they have misgivings, support the war because maybe they just think it's not that important, or because they want to get other things done and they don't want to fight about this, or maybe they have their own ambitions and they don't want to be tarred with, you know, they're looking over their shoulder and they don't want to be tarred with the charge of being wimpy. And this was a dynamic you saw when the Democrats in Congress, many of them supported the war in Iraq outwardly, but had private misgivings. And so it's much cheaper, quote unquote, for Republican presidents who tend to be more hawkish to obtain the dovish support for fighting a war than it is for dovish leaders to obtain hawkish support for staying out. So the insider's game, I argue then, in the end, does produce a hawkish bias, right? So this is where we get into elites are not as great as the people who put them on a pedestal suggest. And I don't make any, you know, we shouldn't be under any illusions about this. There is certainly a hawkish bias, I think, that helps resolve this paradox of Democrats are always looking over their shoulder, and yet they fight lots of wars. And so, but it also suggests that under some circumstances, elites can be themselves, and that includes doves sort of deciding to stay out. It just comes at a much greater political cost.
Thanks so much. You've talked a bit about this already, but I'd like for you to expand on it. You dedicate a large portion of the discussion in your book to how wars fought by the U.S. in places like Korea, Vietnam, Lebanon, Iraq, and Afghanistan reveal different aspects of the insider's game. What does each of these wars tell us about the insider's game?
So this is where we get to talk about curses and misadventures. So when I started to think about how to organize the cases, it struck me again that the Democrats were often choosing, seemingly reluctantly, if you go back through the documents, that they are not enthusiastic fighters of these wars, but they fight these long protracted wars or extend wars that they inherit in some cases without much hope of winning, right? And they know that. Their eyes are open as they're doing this. And Republicans sort of seem to want some sort of resolution one way or the other. And so it led me to these two sort of ideal typical or mistakes, quote unquote, or we can think of them as almost distortions from Democratic distortions. We can think of these as Democratic distortions, two kind of ideal typical departures from what we'd expect if the voters were sort of voting on this as in a referendum like Brexit. I don't know if Brexit is considered a curse word in the UK at this point. So the first example of this is what I call the dove's curse. So again, Democrats or dovish leaders who Democrats tend to be more dovish often want to get other things done. And they often delude themselves into thinking that they can neutralize issues by doing just enough to kind of not lose the war, but not so much that they actually would win, because that would require such a big commitment that it would actually overwhelm their other priorities. And in order to do that, they have to appease the hawks, again, because they brought the hawks in through selection pressures, because they don't want to be tarred with this sort of wimpy dove or hand their opponents this wimpy dove cudgel that they can use against them in other fights. They want to just conserve their political capital for other things. And so you see Democratic presidents making these incremental choices that just keep increasing or prolonging the commitment to using military force without much resolution. So you see this in Korea, where Truman appeases Douglas MacArthur, who is much more hawkish and had flirted with the idea of running for president as a Republican, and constantly was pushing for more aggressive policies in Korea than Truman really wanted. And he appeases MacArthur sort of all the way up to the point where MacArthur's insubordination becomes intolerable. You see this in Vietnam, where Lyndon Johnson just continually adds more troops, knowing that he doesn't really expect that there will be a victory in the classic sense, but he wants to stave off defeat so that he can pass the Great Society. I think Barack Obama also fell victim to what I call a dove's curse in Afghanistan, where he really was not relishing the idea of adding more troops, extending the conflict, but felt that he couldn't afford not to. And, you know, I have always wondered whether the fact that he had to make this decision about the Afghanistan surge in 2009 with the fight over healthcare looming is sort of analogous to Johnson and the Great Society. When you look at the cases of Republicans, you see something very different. You see often what I call hawks misadventures. So sometimes hawks make relatively prudent choices. You think of George H.W. Bush sending overwhelming force to eject Saddam Hussein from Kuwait and then making the explicit, you know, actively deciding not to go all the way to Baghdad and topple Saddam Hussein. One could take issue with U.S. decision-making in the first Gulf War, but I think in general, those decisions are seen as relatively prudent, especially in light of the second Iraq War. But the invasion of Iraq in 2003, I think it shows what both the blessing and the curse of being a hawk, right? So it was relatively easy for Bush to get into that war because he didn't have to pay a huge political price up front to get the support of Democrats and so forth. Most of those concessions were procedural, right? Go to the UN, go to Congress, and you know, he was able to obtain authorization with almost no limitations on him. And there were many different versions of that circulating around, and he got sort of the cleanest one of the bunch. And so getting in is easy, but once you're in, you are the party that's known for being strong on national security. And so you can't screw it up and without paying a political cost. And eventually it catches up to you. And so you see this in the Iraq War with the 2006 midterms, which is one of those cases where you really do see war and national security coming to the fore, and the public sent a very clear signal in the 2006 midterms that they were dissatisfied with the Iraq war. The following day, after those midterms, Bush fires Donald Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense, but he doesn't actually do what the voters were clamoring for, which was to end the U.S. commitment in Iraq. In fact, he doubles down and he goes for the surge. So I think this is a good example of, you know, listening to elites rather than the immediate signal from the voters. But I think what he's really doing there is seeking some kind of resolution, right? He doesn't, his choices are withdrawal or surge. And I think, you know, he chooses surge as almost a gamble for some kind of resolution. And it's not the choice that every hawk makes, right? So in the other Republican case I look at is the case of Ronald Reagan's intervention in Lebanon in 1983, where Reagan is quite committed to this and to the very end wants to keep Marines in Lebanon. Public is pretty permissive. I mean, they're not thrilled about it, but even after the bombing of the Marine barracks in October of 1983, public opinion doesn't really change that much. But members of his own party are quite skeptical. And then the previous support from the Democratic House Speaker, Tip O'Neill, famously political operator in U.S. politics, began to erode. And Reagan realized that this elite consensus that he'd sort of put together was with duct tape was about to fracture. He had other things he wanted to do, but they were in the realm of national security. He couldn't afford to let this tarnish his reputation in national security. And so he listened to those within his own party and within the White House who were telling him, his own advisors were telling him, you've got to end this. And so he, quote unquote, redeployed the Marines offshore, which is a fancy way of saying he withdrew them from their position at the airport in Beirut. So you see sort of Democrats ending up in these long protracted conflicts and Republicans sort of at either end of the spectrum. They either seek a resolution, whether that means ending a conflict or escalating it to what they believe will be victory.
So how do your insights change the way that we should think about war, particularly with respect to modern conflicts in Gaza and Ukraine?
These are great questions. I think one of the things that the book highlights is that often the dissent that really matters comes from within the president's own party. And you see that over and over again. It's not always the case. And sometimes they are facing, you know, multiple different elite groups constraining them. But you often find that dissent from within is the thing that finally sort of like breaks the logjam in terms of elite consensus. I mean, I think a theme of the book is that it takes a long time to break an elite consensus. They're relatively durable and they last longer than you would think. We have this image in our minds of protests of the Iraq War, Vietnam War in 1968, for example, and they certainly were damaging and had a profound impact on society. But the wars themselves went on, right? The, you know, 1968 was by no means the end of the Vietnam War. The Iraq War, the protests happened up front and didn't seem to have much of an effect on the initial invasion. What actually tends to really bring presidents to the table in terms of thinking about a change of course is dissent from within their own party. And so we're right in the beginning of the presidential election campaign in earnest, now that it's clear we're going to have a Trump-Biden rematch. And there's been a lot of discussion about Democratic dissatisfaction with U.S. support for Israel. And I think it's a stretch to say that Biden is responding only to this pressure and the fear of losing Michigan. I mean, there's never any one monocausal explanation in these situations. But I have no doubt that I also think he's sincerely displeased with the Netanyahu government. But there's no doubt that pressure from within the Democratic Party can have real influence on the politics of supporting Israel or putting pressure on Israel and so forth. And so that's certainly one lesson. I think Ukraine is a really tragically interesting, shall we say, case, in part because the Republican Party's politics with respect to Russia have been so scrambled by Trump. If there's one thing that I think is a lasting legacy of Trump, the Trump's administration on the Republican Party in the context of foreign policy, it's the sea change in their views of Russia. And if you look at the trends, it's almost unthinkable up until 2016 to imagine the Republican Party not taking a strong stand on Russia. The pilgrimages to the Reagan Library for debates, right? You would go there and they would talk about being tough on national security and venerate Reagan and so forth. This time we had a Republican primary debate at the Reagan Library in California where it was up for debate whether the United States should take a strong stand on Russia. And the candidates who supported taking a strong stand on Russia, which of course is the Reagan legacy, didn't win. Nikki Haley was the last one standing, and she was soundly defeated in the subsequent primaries. So Trump's really changed the dynamics there. And so I think we certainly can understand, you know, it's always important to understand where we've been in order to understand where we're going. But the change in the Republican Party's orientation, which I think has really translated, I mean, my colleague at Good Authority, Michael Tesler, has nicely shown in a series of posts that the Republican Party has become much more isolationist, much more skeptical of using military force, but that has really been driven by Trump. And that, I think, has scrambled some of these party brands and reputations. And it will be very interesting to see whether that makes it easier for sort of doves to be themselves, or whether the shadow of the, you know, your week on national security just will not let up for Democrats.
Thank you. So you close your book with a final discussion about whether elite-centric foreign policy can necessarily be democratic. Could you briefly talk about why you chose to end with this question and what the implications of it are?
This question of whether it's still democratic if we shift our focus to elites and not voters is pretty fundamental. And it felt to me it didn't sit well with me for a long time to be writing about democracies in a way that almost sounds like autocracies, right? A bunch of, you know, a small group of people making all the decisions and the accountability is within. And scholars who've studied autocracies and war have really made great strides in understanding how autocratic elites can constrain some kinds of dictators, where you have sort of a ruling group as opposed to personalist dictators. So I didn't want it to, I was uncomfortable with the idea of suggesting that these were equivalent, right? A small group in democracies and a small group of elites in autocracies. But I, you know, reading democratic theory and thinking about how the democratic process works, I came around to the idea that it is actually democratic. It can feel icky and unseemly to read about the horse trading that goes on. And some of it is really quite, I mean, Arthur Vandenberg was the one who famously coined this idea of like politics stops at the water's edge. And I write about this in a recent foreign affairs piece called Politics Can't Stop at the Water's Edge that is drawn from the book. And Vandenberg this is kind of what he's famous for is, you know, can't have politics in national security, can't play politics with national security. Vandenberg played plenty of politics with national security and exactly the kind of sort of icky careerism that you might expect. And one of the ways he did that was he was the one who brokered John Foster Dulles coming into the Truman administration. And there was all kinds of haggling over what was Dulles's title going to be and what, you know, how much power would he have, and explicitly saying that if they didn't do something about Taiwan policy, that he wouldn't get Dulles's blessing, which of course meant the Republican senators that supported him. Right. I mean, it was very explicitly political behind the scenes. And so there is this sort of tradition of like outward sanctimony about bipartisanship or nonpartisanship, even as we are able in retrospect to see all of this inside politicking that goes on. So how do we understand that as democratic? You know, again, I come back to this is just how we all make sense of the world. And we can't just idealize voters and say, well, how can we get to a more perfect expression of what the voters want? this is part of democracy, right? It's just part of how democracy works. And so, again, I come back to sort of can't live with them and can't live without them. We need to have a better understanding of elite politics in order to understand how to make them better. And so it's just the sort of, I guess you could say, small R realist, meaning just being realistic about what we can and can't expect of voters. And so I do think that a theory of elite politics can fit, if uncomfortably, with democratic norms.
Thank you so much. Well, that's the end of my substantive questions. I'd just like to invite you to talk about anything else you've got coming up. You mentioned the article as well. So if you'd like to, anything else you want to promote?
Well, I think it's an election season, and it's a very, shall we say, unusual election. We have one incumbent, and almost, it's almost like we have an election between two incumbents. And it's a very strange time because there's this dissatisfaction with Biden among some who might like an alternative to Trump. Maybe it's because of age. Maybe it's sort of lingering dissatisfaction with the economy, even though it's by many, most all measures, I'm no economist, but doing quite well. But people still feel the effects of high prices and inflation, as they certainly have here in the UK. And so good news takes a longer time and is to filter through to voter sentiment. And of course, everything now is framed through the lens of partisan polarization. So I have been thinking a lot about what does this election mean and how do we understand it in terms of foreign policy? And I do think it is really a fork in the road. I mean, Trump has a track record of doing what he says or trying to do what he says. And this time he's clearly wanted to withdraw the US from NATO. I think he could do so in for all practical purposes, even if the legal commitment remains. He can order the troops home. He can do a lot of things to undercut NATO without the formal withdrawal. So Congress can pass all the laws it wants, but the governing of troops is, the deployment of troops is really up to the president as commander in chief. And so I think this is a crossroads election. So I've been thinking a lot about that. And also this idea that the second time around, Trump has a whole apparatus kind of ready to help him implement his agenda in ways that he really didn't the first time. And so the role of expertise and experience and what we do with the elites that made terrible decisions in the Iraq War, like how do we think about them, has been much on my mind. And there are parties that are populists and who rail against the elites. Just this week in the UK, you had the defection of one of the former Tories to the new Reform Party, the successor to the UKIP party. And if you listen to his speech, he talks about the taking back the country and all of this. And I guess a theme of what I've been working on lately is to move away from this dichotomy of elites are warmongers and we need to, you know, they made terrible decisions before, and so we need to just throw them out and get new people, versus the like technocratic expertise is really what we need. We have to be a little more clear-eyed, right? We have to understand that elites make mistakes. They also have successes that we never hear about or that don't get a lot of attention. We haven't had a major escalation in Ukraine, and that has drawn NATO in. And I think that is the result of a lot of hard work that gets very little attention, except from people who follow these things closely. Diplomacy is often invisible. And so I think we need to get to a point where we can accept the need for competence and expertise in various countries, in regions, and so forth, and not put elites on a pedestal or demonize them as a group. And so that's been a theme of some of my recent writing that I hope fast recedes into irrelevance.
Professor Elizabeth Sanders, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Elizabeth Sanders is Professor of Political Science at Columbia University. And that's it for this extra inning of The Ballpark. Thanks so much to Professor Elizabeth Sanders for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On Twitter and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on Facebook, we're LSE United States. This extra inning was produced by Chris Gilson and Anderson Tan. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US. And tell your friends about us. If you'd like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It really helps other people to find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.